It's the NPR News Update for Monday, June 16th. Hi, I'm Phil Picardi with the podcast. Coming up, Medtronic is taking on an Irish firm and moving executive offices to Ireland. A civil rights director is seen by some as not being very kind. An original streetcar motorman goes for a ride on the Green Line. And Kathy Werzer has another interview with Bruce Kramer, a Twin Cities man dying of ALS. First, Fridley-based Medtronic has agreed to buy Irish healthcare products company Covidien for nearly $43 billion. The deal would move Medtronic's executive offices to Ireland, where Covidien is based. Medtronic's operational headquarters and chief executive would remain in Minnesota, where the company currently employs more than 8,000 people. Company spokesman Rob Clark says the deal would free up cash between the two companies.
The two entities have billions of trapped cash sitting off of the United States that we now get access to, particularly the Covidien cash that's sitting outside the United States. And that's money, again, that we can take and now reinvest back in technology development and innovation here in the U.S.
The companies have combined revenues from outside the U.S. of $13 billion. Ireland currently has a corporate tax rate of 12.5%, while the U.S. corporate tax rate is about 35%. Clark says the company made a commitment to the state that it will add 1,000 jobs in Minnesota over the next 5 years. He expects the transaction to close by the end of this year or early next. Business reporter Martin Moylan and Morning Edition host Kathy Werzer talked about the Medtronic-Covidien marriage this morning.
What is the reason company officials are giving for this move?
Well, it's a good business fit. There's not an awful lot of overlap between the two companies. They're going to have a combined entity that's going to be able to offer a broader portfolio of medical devices, supplies, and equipment. Pacemakers, staples, stents, they'll pretty much have much of what a medical hospital would need. Also, there are significant tax benefits here. This will allow Medtronic to bring back to the U.S. overseas profits that if they did it now, they'd be facing a 35% tax rate. So what they're going to do is they'll pay taxes on those overseas profits in Ireland. Then they're going to be able to get the money back into the U.S. for R&D and investment and acquisitions.
I know that there's a conference call going on right now, so thanks for being with us. You're live. But is Medtronic saying anything specific about the tax benefits of this?
They do acknowledge that they'll be able to bring back those overseas profits to the U.S. and do it without taking as much of a tax hit if they were to directly bring it back into the U.S. They do acknowledge that, but they're saying that the main driver are the business synergies.
Is this really an Irish company that Medtronic is buying?
For tax purposes, it is. They acknowledge their operational headquarters is going to be here. The meat and potatoes will be here. But for tax purposes, they'll be domiciled in Ireland.
Okay. Now, as you know, mergers often include layoffs. Are there layoffs in this one, perhaps?
Well, they're promising that there won't be any net loss of jobs in Minnesota. In fact, they've said that they'll be adding about 1,000 jobs here over the next 5 years or so. But they are talking about $850 million in savings. Savings often mean bodies. They don't need two HR departments, two marketing departments. There will probably be job losses. But again, they're saying here, Minnesota is going to see a net increase in jobs.
What did the CEO say to Governor Mark Dayton about this?
Well, that's what he conveyed to Dayton. He said that, don't worry about losing a lot of jobs in Minnesota as a result of this transaction. In fact, it will make us a stronger player in Minnesota. We're going to be adding jobs, investing money, growing our company in Minnesota.
Is this a good strategic fit for Medtronic? You alluded to it a little bit ago, but maybe expand on that for me.
Well, there isn't, too much overlap between the two companies, so they're going to be able to go to hospitals and other end users and say, we've got more of what you need. We got pacemakers, we got staples, we got surgical supplies, so a broader array of products for their customers, a more consolidated buying opportunity.
What are you to be looking for now the rest of the day as you head into this story?
Well, more elaboration on the tax benefits. I mean, some people look at this and go, you're domiciling an island, you're playing some sort of tax game. But they're saying that their effective tax rate isn't really going to change that much, but it's going to facilitate them getting more money back to the U.S. and growing the company in the U.S. and R&D, and they're casting this as a net benefit to their U.S. operations.
That's Marty Moylan and Kathy Werzer this morning. And on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. The Minneapolis Civil Rights Director finds herself again surrounded by controversy 3 months after she survived a bruising confirmation hearing. The recently released text of a speech Velma Korbel made last year to employees lends credence to complaints about her management style. And she's engaged in an unusually public feud with the chair of the City Council Committee overseeing her department. Curtis Gilbert reports.
Last week, a former city employee sent 4 council members copies of a speech Korbel gave about a year ago at a staff meeting. The message from Korbel was that unhappy employees needed to change their attitudes or look for new jobs. "You know who you are," she said. "Worse, I know who you are." Korbel said the unnamed, unhappy employees were endangering their future careers, and not just with the city. She noted that she and other managers know a lot of people in the metro. In the speech, she asked, quote, "How hard do you think it's going to be if you try to advance your career and you don't have these people in your corner?" Seema Desai took that as a threat.
So it seemed to me that she was flexing her political power and silencing the staff from speaking out.
Desai quit her job as a civil rights investigator a month later. She obtained a copy of Korbel's remarks as part of a lawsuit against the city that she recently settled for $38,000. And she was the one who sent the document to city leaders. Councilmember Cam Gordon was taken aback by what he read.
"That stuff was very disturbing, shocking, and it's not anything that I would ever expect and want to have any supervisor, manager, or department head in the city of Minneapolis say to their staff."
Gordon says he's glad the council has asked an outside management consultant to review the work environment at the Civil Rights Department. Korbel acknowledges her speech was inartful, but she says she never intended to threaten staff for voicing concerns.
"People who know me and have worked for me for a long time understand that I have a very direct style, and I also am not a mincer of words."
Some of Korbel's more recent words have also drawn criticism. Last month, she participated in a panel discussion organized by the African American Caucus of the Minnesota DFL Party. According to news reports, she took a jab at first-term city council member Blong Yang, saying, quote, "I don't think he knows he's supposed to represent the community."
"It just smelled bad, it looked bad, and it was just awful."
Council member Yang detected racial undertones in Korbel's remark.
"I think essentially what she said was just that, you know, a Hmong person like myself just can't represent the folks in North Minneapolis because, you know, it's predominantly African American."
Korbel is Black, and she was politically connected to Yang's African American predecessor, Don Samuels. Yang says the fact that Korbel apparently got away with her comment indicates a double standard.
"Imagine if she was, you know, some old white guy and she said something like that. Most people would be calling for his head. I mean, here is the civil rights director, somebody who's supposed to protect our civil rights, and she is discriminating."
In an interview, Korbel denied her comment was discriminatory. She didn't dispute the accuracy of the quote or offer an apology.
"But this is what I will say about Councilmember Blong Yang and every council member on third floor. I wish all of them the best success as council members, and my department and I are ready to assist them with whatever work they think they need to do out in their wards or in the city."
Korbel and Yang have clashed over the city's approach to addressing disparities between white and minority residents, but their dispute also has a personal dimension. Yang was one of 3 council members to vote against confirming Korbel for a second term due to complaints from employees about her management style. He also had firsthand experience with those issues, having worked under her for a year as a civil rights investigator. Now, as a council member, Yang chairs the committee that oversees her department. But he's not her boss. Mayor Betsy Hodges is. And in spite of the continued controversy, Hodges is standing behind Korbel. In a statement, the mayor credited Korbel with improving the department, which used to suffer from a chronic backlog of cases. "Change is not always smooth or easy," the statement said. But Velma has a track record of moving our civil rights work in the right direction.
That's Curtis Gilbert in Minneapolis. The Green Line light rail is rolling for real now. The Metro Transit link connects the downtowns of Minneapolis and St. Paul by rail, and paying commuters and riders are riding the train today. It's been 60 years since streetcars did just that and more, connecting the downtowns and neighborhoods all over the Twin Cities. Until the 1950s, it would cost you a dime, or 7.5 cents if you had tokens, to hop on the streetcar and shop or go to work. Bob Stevenson was a streetcar motorman who remembers those days well. He talked with Tom Cran at Union Depot in St. Paul before boarding the train to Target Field.
I started in 1953 as a streetcar motorman.
Okay.
And drove streetcar for 2 years before they switched over to buses.
What did you think when that happened? You were working on the line when they basically closed up the streetcars.
I was going to miss them.
Yeah.
There was some advantages to the buses, but I think the advantages were outweighed by the conveniences of the streetcar. Because in the streetcar days, you never looked at a schedule. What you did is went out and stood on the corner, because the maximum time between streetcars during the day was 15 minutes.
We're gonna get on one of these new Green Line trains in just a moment here. We're at Union Depot waiting to get on, and I understand it's pretty tight, even though their tests, pretty tight schedule. Okay. So we got to, as they used to say, step lively and watch the closing doors.
Right.
We're taking this train? We taking this one? All right, well, let's get on and see what it's like.
Okay.
So, Bob, we're on one of these new cars, and the first thing I noticed, it's like a new car. It's got new train smell.
Right, it does. It's just like brand new. It's be my first ride ever on one of the new ones.
Uh-huh.
And I think it really, for the passengers' comfort and all, it's really quite a difference from the old ones where they sat on wicker seats. And
you were the only operator, I assume. You ran night lines. You were the conductor and the pilot of the thing.
You were the motorman in one day. We called them one-man cars. And there was a reason that all the drivers, as motormen, preferred one-man cars, was that if you had a conductor, you made 10 cents an hour less than if you were by yourself. And for in those days, starting wage for a motorman was $1.75 an hour, which a person working that at those wages could support a family, believe it or not. Back in 1950, you could support your family fairly well.
You know what, I'm going to try to get a peek. Do you want to go up and try to see into the platform there where the where today's motorman sits?
They've got a better view, better windshield wipers, and everything. You know, we had one you reached up and pulled down when you wanted to wipe the...
Oh, really? Manual windshield wiper?
Oh, yeah. Some of them had manual windshield wipers.
There's nothing manual, it looks like, about that. Looks pretty automated. Don't you think?
Oh, yeah. And they've got quite a...
pretty high-tech.
High-tech, and the television camera showing along the side of the car instead of a mirror is a much better means of observing your passengers getting on and off.
Right.
Much, much more better.
So look at the speed we're at on the track. We're going at a pretty good clip here, aren't we?
Yes, we are. If you had been driving the old yellow bananas, as we called them, you would be rattling back and forth like you wouldn't believe.
It's straightaway here on University Avenue now.
Right. And if you look down the straightaway, it looks like it's a perfectly straight line. The rails are very, very smooth. And we used to clickety-clack.
Mm-hmm.
Along
because
at each where the rails were joined together, they weren't welded, they were just put together with bolts.
Oh, really? Okay.
And
So you'd get a ka-chuk,
yeah, all the way along, and you go, well, it was more like a clackety-clack, clack, clack. Keep you awake.
Any harrowing runs in those days, either accidents or near accidents or incidents?
I would think the most near incident I had was Lowry Hill in Minneapolis coming down it. I blew an airline. No brakes. What do? You coast down the hill and...
ring the bell.
Ring the bell a lot. There was a bell that you had there and you could clang like crazy, you know. And I went about, after I went through there, I went about two blocks before I finally got it stopped.
So we are coming up here to the city line. I'm going to cross over from St. Paul to Minneapolis.
Right.
The streetcars, it sounds like, in those days were a major way that people got around, as much as bus today or train?
I would say in those days, less than 50% of the people owned cars, and they depended on streetcars. There was no place in Minneapolis or St. Paul that you couldn't get and reasonable walking, and people didn't mind walking three or four blocks in those days. No place you couldn't go.
So take us back to the time, what year are we talking, 54, 55, when the streetcars were closed down?
Right. The last one ran in 55. They started closing them down in 54. The beginning of 54 is when they started closing down more and more and more of them is converting over to buses.
What was the reaction, public reaction?
People bought cars. That's about what it amounted to. Traffic increased tremendously, which when you're driving a bus, you get more traffic.
Slows the bus down.
Slows the bus down. I mean, it can't drive over the top or anything else.
Once you were driving the bus, and you say you did that for over 10 years after the streetcars, was there any time that you imagined the two downtowns would be connected again by a train of some kind?
Never a thought in my mind. That was probably the farthest thing from anybody doing something like this. I think it's an excellent idea, but it would have probably should have been done 50 years ago.
Well, we're coming to Target Field here, the end of our ride. What do you make of it?
I think it was a very pleasant ride. You know, I enjoyed riding a very smooth and quiet ride.
Bob Stevenson, thanks so much for riding the Green Line with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me along. I appreciate you taking me with me.
Bob Stevenson was a trolley motorman and later bus driver for the Twin Cities Lines starting in 1953. He went with Tom Cran on a preview trip on Metro Transit's Green Line. Perhaps you've heard of Bruce Kramer. Kathy Werzer has brought us his story for months. Today in her series, Kathy brings us a look at what a devastating illness can do to a family.
In any given year, it's estimated that about 30% of the U.S. population is a caregiver for an ill or elderly family member. If you're not a caregiver now, it's likely that you will be someday. Ev Emerson finds herself in that role. Ev is the wife of Bruce Kramer, the Twin Cities man we've been following, who's been living with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, since being diagnosed in December of 2010. Kramer is worried about the effect of his illness on Ev and the rest of his family. He wrote about some of his concerns in a blog entry called The Sum of My Fears.
After my diagnosis, I found myself hovering over my memory of our marriage vows like an out-of-body experience. I actually wondered if Ev had any inkling of what was to come. Would she have cast her lot with me? I realized that the knowledge I was coming to understand was not only my fear of what ALS was doing to me, but it was the dawning realization of what ALS care was going to do to my beloved partner and my wonderful sons.
I talked with Bruce Kramer and Ev Emerson in June of 2012 about their lives in the shadow of ALS. Recently, I checked back in.
It's going better now that I'm working part-time. It took a really bad breakdown of health for me finally to realize that I can't work full time. In November, I couldn't get well. I came down with something, missed 2 complete weeks of school. It developed into pneumonia, and I realized something has to give. So I have since then dropped my work schedule down to about 75%. And it just buys me a couple hours each day to make sure I take care of myself. And that's been a very good thing to do.
She's right. And experts agree. The demands on a caregiver's body, mind, and spirit can be overwhelming. And caretakers have to take care of themselves, too, which is easier said than done, especially if a caregiver also works outside the home. Ev teaches music at the Normandale Elementary French Immersion School in Edina. This recent graduation ceremony at the school marks the end of the school year and the start of summer vacation, a time for Ev to rest and rejuvenate.
I talk about filling the well because my job is such. I'm a teacher, and I'm giving and giving and giving, and my well gets dry, so I have to have things that will fill the water back up again. And those 3 things, I tell Bruce, if I can exercise, meditate, and play the piano, those seem to be the things that fill up the well again for me, so I can go on.
Those are things that get her recentered, and then our time is much, much better, even if I have one of those horrible hard nights where I just cannot sleep because of the pain.
Sometimes that pain goes beyond the physical. Ev says despite trying to keep an even emotional keel, there are waves of sadness that wash over them both.
I guess Bruce would probably admit it, that we probably cry together at least once a day over something, and then we move on. I feel so grateful most of the time that I don't like to dwell on the things that are unpleasant.
This is a very busy place. We have different people, volunteers and paid caregivers coming in every day, and I'm never alone anymore. I have somebody with me 24/7. And so when it's just Ev with me, not only does it remove the busyness from the environment, but it also breaks down a lot of the defenses. They kind of go out the door with the last person who was here. I think that just leaves us both vulnerable to triggers. I might say something about, I don't know, something that I wonder if I'll have the time for, or Ev might be thinking about something that she knows I can't participate in. And then we kind of get a little teary-eyed and we come back together and center back into the moment. We sure do enjoy our time together in the late evening, though, when it's just us.
With any progressive illness, there is a loss of control, not only for the individual, but for the caregiver. Are you experiencing that too?
Oh, sure. It certainly has impacted my life. Even a year ago, I'm thinking, I used to sneak out. I was able to leave Bruce for an hour at a time. So I could sneak out, ride a bike for an hour, and come back. And I can't do that anymore. So my world has shrunk as Bruce's world has shrunk.
Control is an illusion. And ALS is one of those things that just, it's quite adamant that you learn that lesson and learn it soon. You think you have control. You think you can place that control. But this body will do what it will do. And I can't make it do any more than that.
And there's no way to control the advancing hold ALS has on Kramer's body. As he becomes weaker, there's a copy of his advanced care directive taped to the refrigerator door. It's in an envelope marked with big, bold letters. POLST, pulsed, or Provider Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. If Bruce were to choke or have another medical issue, this document spells out what should be done, which is very little. There are do not resuscitate and do not intubate orders.
I remember filling out the pulsed form, and that was an opportunity we both sat and cried. I accept his decisions, what he wants to do, but you look at that, it's right out in black and white, and I have to respect that. I worry that I would be there, well, of course I would be there, if he couldn't breathe, and I really don't want to even imagine that, what would happen. I know I'd call 911, but I know that they would also look at the thing that's sitting on the refrigerator. And it's really hard to contemplate that.
I think, in a way, it's healthy. I wonder why we don't have Ebbs pulsed for him up, frankly. And, I mean, why hasn't she talked with her doctor about it? And do you have a pulsed form? Why not? I mean, there are times when decisions get taken out of my hands, and these are my wishes as best as I can express them. I think that's a healthy thing to do.
But, Ev, I've talked to other caregivers. When you get to that point and your loved one says, this is what I want, it's hard to let go.
Yes. I remember when we talked at the Mayo about end of life, and we talked with one of the doctors, and he said, what you don't want to do is have to make a decision in the crush of the moment in an emergency. You don't want to make that decision, because once you are intubated, then what do you do? And so it's better to have it thought out ahead of time, so that in that emergency, you already know what your loved one's wishes are, and you do that. It's like practicing for a fire drill, so that when the real thing happens, you know what to do. And we have done that. We've taken those steps. It wasn't easy to talk that out, but that's part of this whole process.
How has your marriage been changing through all of this? How has the dynamic, the emotional dynamic changed, if at all?
The emotional dynamic, I don't see a change. I don't want to say we're lucky, but there's a saying about riding a tandem bicycle, that a tandem bicycle will take your marriage to where it was going twice as fast. And in a lot of ways, this for us has been like a tandem bicycle. There are places where there is a depth of connection that I don't believe we ever knew before. There are other places, of course, where I would dearly, dearly love to take a walk and hold hands. And that would be delicious. But those are places you let go of.
We've pared this relationship down so that we're both so open to each other. It's a different depth, I feel like, a different depth of relationship.
Well, and let's be clear, there are some things that with my particular progression with ALS that have made it easier. I mean, I don't have frontal temporal dementia. As I continue to lose physical function, I feel this deep spiritual intertwining between the two of us.
Because you two so clearly love each other, you have such a wonderful love story. Through all the changes that have occurred, though, how do you keep the spark?
That's a secret.
Bruce Kramer and his wife, Ev Emerson, talking about living with ALS. This is the 25th installment of our series of conversations. We have them all archived at mprnews.org.
That's our Kathy Werzer. I'm Phil Picardi. This is the NPR News Update on Monday, June 16. Thanks for joining me today. The Tuesday News right back here tomorrow.